responsibility for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, AFGE 3rd District National Vice President Keith Hill will address the challenges transportation security officers face at the workplace, while author Michael Zweig stops by to discuss his book, The Working Class Majority. But first, AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon joins us to discuss the House GOP 2013 budget proposal. Jackie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, House Republicans have submitted their proposal for the budget for 2013. Talk about the proposal and what that impact would be on federal employees.
Well, this proposed budget, it's not that different from the one that the House Republicans put forward last year. And it's not a fully elaborated budget. It's a policy document. And it's extraordinary in its dishonesty and how outrageous the ideas for cutting the government are. As far as specifically for federal employees, there's the idea of extending the pay freeze an additional 3 years so that federal pay will have been frozen for 5 full years. There's a proposal to reduce federal employment across the board by 10% just through attrition, not through any kind of planning, but when someone retires or leaves, just not to replace them. And it proposes tens of billions of dollars of additional retirement system cuts that are unspecified in terms of details, but they're still very large cuts. But those are the sort of specific federal employee compensation cuts and mandatory job cuts. But from the big picture perspective, they propose to slash spending on all government programs outside of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security from the current 12% or 12.5% of GDP to 3.75% of GDP. So if you think about that, that's by 2050. It's a long, long decline, but generally speaking, the idea would be that 35 years from now, 40 years from now, spending on defense, food stamps, all infrastructure spending, education, the entire federal workforce, all the agencies of government would be cut by about two-thirds.
That's an impressive statistic there, Jackie, cutting the services from 12% of GDP to 3.75%. What's that impact on public service?
12.5%. It would eliminate it. I mean, I think it's not too strong to say that it would eliminate in the short run, it's eliminating everything but defense, drastic cuts in Medicaid, eventually drastic cuts in Medicare. Interesting. I mean, there's a lot of illogic in this budget, but, they want to force Medicare recipients into exchanges. But, of course, there won't be any exchanges if they do the other thing they propose, which is to repeal the health care reform law. So it's a very unserious document. It's really outrageous. And the most outrageous thing of all is, not the most outrageous thing of all, but something that people should really pay attention to is the fact that Mitt Romney, the likely Republican presidential nominee, his only comment was that he thought it was exciting and wonderful, and he supported it and embraced it.
Jackie, aside from what the impact would be on public service, what about the employees who serve the American people? What's the impact on them? We've already seen federal employees in the midst of a two-year pay freeze, and you added that the proposal is to include 3 more years. What does that do in terms of recruitment and retaining federal employees?
Well, I suppose it depends on whether the labor market will have improved by that time. But obviously, people who have an opportunity to go elsewhere for higher pay will do so, and people who have an opportunity to perform work at a higher salary in the private sector or state and local government will choose that rather than federal employment. Meanwhile, the people who stay in federal employment will just have their living standards decline. The pay freeze while horrendous and unjustified and punitive and mean-spirited and wrong, wouldn't probably be the biggest hit on federal employees if this budget were to pass as is. Part of the proposal includes big tax cuts for the wealthy and for the middle class, and they're cutting taxes at the same time as they're cutting spending. So when they, in order to cut taxes by that much and still raise the amount of revenue they say they're going to raise, they would have to get rid of many, many tax deductions that federal employees, like all other middle-class taxpayers, rely upon, and that's the mortgage interest deduction, the tax-free status of the value of employer-provided health insurance and retirement savings. If that were to go into effect, that would have a bigger economic impact on our members than even the pay freeze.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Jackie Simon, AFGE's Public Policy Director. Jackie, as you know, federal employees are already working under difficult circumstances. Many of the agencies are understaffed and underfunded. You referenced earlier that this, if this plan goes through, the possibility is there that some of these services would simply just go away. Do you think the American people will accept that?
Well, honestly, I think that the chances of this budget becoming law are pretty remote to non-existent. So, no, of course, the American people wouldn't want that. I think that, you know, to the extent that people pay attention to something like this, I can't imagine that it can do anything other than cost its supporters political support. I don't think that the American people are that mean-spirited. I don't think that there's any evidence the American people don't want Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid or government support for education and transportation. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that the American people don't want a safe food supply, workplace safety, you know, all the other kinds of important services provided by federal government agencies. People are very supportive of those programs and the protections and supports that they provide. And of course, they don't want to see those things disappear.
Do you think that the authors of the proposal understand some of these consequences, understand that some of these agencies would take some real hits under this proposal?
You know, it's tempting to say that the authors of these proposals are profoundly uninformed. On the other hand, they have to know to some degree what they're doing. I think that they are under the impression that, that people, hate the government and everything it does. And, you know, while anti-government rhetoric is often popular, the actual programs that the government carries out are very popular. I mean, I don't think that there's any kind of widespread support for the United States government telling veterans, drop dead, no, we're not providing you any health care, no, you're not getting any benefits, go away and leave us alone. I don't think there's support for contaminated meat and poultry and fish. I don't think there's any support for unsafe pharmaceuticals. I don't think there's really a lot of support for, dirty air and water that's unsafe to drink or bathe in. I don't think that the American people really want that kind of society, but that's the society they'd be getting if this budget were enacted in its entirety.
And so what then do you think the motivation would be for proposing a budget like this?
I think these people might be sort of highly, highly ideological and drunk on power. And I don't really know what more to say than that. Mm-hmm. They're just so amazingly irresponsible. Just, it's breathtaking how irresponsible and unserious this document is.
Jackie, when you were combing through the details and looking at the particulars, did you see anything in there that would require any changes to the way that contractors are compensated through the federal system?
No, and, you always wonder if they have any kind of, since the document itself doesn't have a trace of integrity or honesty, you have to wonder that, they'll cut all the spending that's, to fund government agencies and allow federal government employees to operate and administer the programs of the federal agencies. And if they cut all those jobs and they still, under law, have the obligation to provide those services, well, what are they going to do? They can't hire federal employees. They'll have to contract out. So we didn't see any kind of curbs on contractor spending. Of course, if these spending caps, which they want to lower, even lower than the caps that were established in the Budget Control Act last summer, contractors are a little bit worried that that might apply to them. They probably don't need to worry. It seems like the only operations that ever gets applied to happen to be federal compensation and federal employment.
Jackie, as we know, last year, budget battles on Capitol Hill led the American government to the brink of a shutdown. And I'm wondering if you think that there's an opportunity for the possibility of another government shutdown with this proposal. Where do you think this is going to take us in the months ahead?
If the House Republicans insist on these terms and none other, yeah, there probably will be a government shutdown.
And how has AFGE been responding to this in the last day or so after learning of the proposal?
Well, there's been a lot of press inquiries. Today, just sort of reading through both the trade press and the national press, this budget is not, it's getting the reaction that it deserves, which is sort of disbelief and sort of shock at the recklessness of it and the cynicism of it and the irresponsibility of it. Certainly, we're talking to lawmakers and talking to our members about what seems to be the platform of at least the House side of the Republican Party and their leading contender for the presidency. We'll see what the Democratic Party's response to it is, but this is a highly political document.
And Jackie, any sense yet from where you're sitting as to how AFGE members have reacted to this or what federal employees are saying about the proposal?
I think federal employees are disgusted. They are really, really tired of the rhetoric of shared sacrifice and then the reality that only they are called upon to make any kind of sacrifice. And the sacrifices they're made to provide never seem to end. Every day, every week, another amendment is added to some bill, some extraneous kind of effort to have federal employees' compensation cut in order to pay for something completely unrelated to federal employees. And you know how they say, if you repeat a lie often enough, it starts to have the ring of truth. And the House Republicans say over and over again that federal employees are overpaid, so that this is just a writing of the pay levels, as opposed to the fact that federal employees, the reality and the truth that federal employees are underpaid compared to private sector and state and local government people who perform the exact same kind of jobs. And so, they're just tired of being the ATM machine for the Congress.
Jackie Simon, AFGE Public Policy Director. Jackie, thank you for your insight on this topic.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE's 3rd District National Vice President Keith Hill will discuss the challenges facing transportation security officers at the workplace.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year. Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member. And in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Keith Hill, AFGE's 3rd District National Vice President, NVP Hill. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jason.
And so today we've got you here at the AFGE TSA Council 100 Founding Convention. Tell us what you've seen so far today.
We're working on the charter, the constitution for the TSA Council. Things seem to be going pretty smoothly. Some changes to the Constitution or to the bylaws, but I think we're moving ahead with it.
How have the TSOs here responded to the convention?
There's a lot of interest in it, Jason. We have a lot of people who are really active with AFGE, really active with TSA, and I think it's going to come off fine.
In your district, in AFGE's District 3, you represent a number of airports, about 14, but in particular two in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh that are very active and have a lot of issues at this time. What are some things that those employees are concerned about?
Their appraisal system, the way they're paid. We have a lot of issues with turnover in staff. It seems a waste to me to train these employees and let them go without any input into the process, without any third-party intervention. It's just a waste of money. It's a waste of resources.
Do you think that the morale being low is directly impacted by the turnover?
It definitely is. The morale, people just don't know what to expect from one day to the next. One day things can be fine. The next day everything goes south. There's no continuity. And the TSOs see that. They understand that. They understand that their jobs are in jeopardy every day, through no fault of their own in a lot of cases. It could be a complaint from a passenger. It could be a complaint from another TSO or from a manager. But there is no continuity, and morale is adversely affected by the lack of continuity.
How do you think that this situation will eventually be rectified?
I think once we have a contract, once we have something that the TSOs can hang their hat on. Once we have third-party intervention so that a person's livelihood can't be taken away by a manager without an independent third party looking at it, I think that will solve a lot of the problems at TSO as far as morale goes, as far as retention of employees, good employees that would have been let go had they not had third-party intervention.
A lot of the members here today and a number of TSOs from around the country, they have been with the organization since day one.
Correct.
How important is it to get something going in a positive direction for those TSOs who have been in it for so long?
I would say it's very important. It's like you cannot keep somebody or have somebody on board for nine years, train them for 9 years, and stroke of a pen, let them go. There is no continuity, and continuity and stability in their position is very important to them. Without that, they have nothing. They have no stability whatsoever. They don't know from one day to the next whether they're going to have a job.
Now, continuity and stability is something that you are very familiar with. You are a longtime local president at AFGE. Toby Hanna, how are things going at your old local?
It's always a struggle, Jason. No matter DOD, Social Security, VA, it's a struggle all over. My local continues to grow. We do have issues there. We've been fighting for approximately 9 years for pay parity at Toby Hanna. Our GS employees were moved into the New York locality area, and our wage grade employees were left in the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area of applicability. It's created tremendous morale problems. When I retired, I was a wage grade 11, and I was making approximately 50 cents more an hour than the GS6 secretary, and was responsible for complex radar systems repair and selling the radar systems to the GI, installing the radar systems. And I'm not taking away the importance of a GS6 secretary, but the training level, I think, at the grade that I retired at was so much more. I had over 3,000 hours of training in the electronics trade. It creates tremendous morale problems. We've been waiting for FPRAC to decide on whether they're redrawing the lines to look more like the GS locality areas. FPRAC sat down, they voted on this months ago, and it's been tied up by OPM and Director Barry since then. We've been promised a decision in March. Hopefully we finally get the decision in March. But it's a constant struggle.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Keith Hill, AFGE's National Vice President of the 3rd District. NVP Hill, you also represent a number of Bureau of Prisons officers in
Correct.
Your district, and they face an uphill battle as well with staffing and funding
Correct.
Deficiencies that really result in a safety issue. Can you talk a little bit about that and their challenges?
Yes, we have 9 federal correctional institutions in Pennsylvania, including 3 penitentiaries. We have Lewisburg, Allenwood, and Canaan penitentiaries. Last year, we had 2 corrections officers stabbed at Lewisburg. Naturally, there's assault. Inmate assault at these prisons on a daily basis. The staffing levels are anything but sufficient. We've been working on, and the BOP Council has been working on, protective gear for the corrections officers. Naturally, that's also an uphill battle. It looks like it's going to take an act of Congress to get them the protective gear that they're looking for. I think in the end, we're probably going to see something, pepper spray, the protective vests that they have. Naturally, we had a problem with that with our female corrections officers. The protective vests were made for men, and they didn't. I think we're finally getting around to getting that solved. There are a number of issues in the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons. Staffing isn't the least of the problems. There's a plethora of problems. Right now, the corrections officers go into areas where there are 125 inmates on one corrections officer. His only protection is a panic button on a radio. He presses the panic button. He hopes helps gets there in time to save his life. So, yes, we have a lot of problems in the Bureau of Prisons. It's like I said, we had 2 corrections officers stabbed in Pennsylvania last year, so it's a continuing problem. It appears like it's going to get worse with the budget cuts.
This really is a matter of life and death, literally, for these men and women who work in a federal prison. They are tasked with a very difficult job, a very stressful job, and given, at this point, essentially the minimum amount of resources to do that job, asked oftentimes to supervise up to 150 inmates by themselves, one person for 150
Correct.
Inmates. When you talk to the correctional officers, do you get a sense of what this does to their workplace morale under these conditions?
Sure, it adversely affects them. I spent 8 hours at Lewisburg Penitentiary touring, and I toured each cell block. What they're doing at Lewisburg is they're actually creating what they call a SHMU, a special management unit at Lewisburg, and they're shipping in all the worst of the worst into Lewisburg. And it's like I said, I spent eight hours there. It's not a pleasant place to be. I wouldn't want to walk into the place every day and have to work there. But every correction officer that I spoke to told me staffing levels, they don't have enough staff, they don't have the protective equipment that they need. Naturally, it affects their morale, it affects their well-being, to tell you the truth. It's a problem. It's like a time bomb. Eventually, somebody's going to get killed, and it's one of the things that I dread, to tell you the truth.
You, as we had mentioned earlier, a longtime local president. You retire, you move on to become a national vice president at AFGE. How has that transition gone for you, and what really excites you about the job that you're in now?
Well, it's a learning experience, Jason. Every day I learn something new. What excites me is being able to help people. It's what I like to do as a local president, as a steward, as a first vice president. Nothing gives me more pleasure than to see somebody who's been wrongly punished, terminated, get their job back, and that's what keeps me going in this position. In all the positions that I've held with AFGE and with the unions.
I get a sense for the passion that you have here, obviously coming from a DOD background, but you talk about some of these issues with BOP and the Social Security Administration and the Veterans Administration with the same type of passion that you have about your own local in the past. Where does that passion come from?
You know, I'm not really sure. It's just that I see the same things going on, and no matter what agency it is, the issues that we face are basically the same. Staffing problems at Social Security, staffing problems at the VA. My son's a veteran. veteran. I was a veteran. I think I understand, anyway, what all of these local presidents and all of the representatives, AFG representatives, go through on a daily basis. I love what I do. It's a good job, and I love helping people.
Lastly, MVP Hill, what are you most looking forward to here in 2012?
Well, on a personal base, I'm looking at continuing to grow my district. That's one of my main concerns when I first took over the office. And I hate to use the word stagnant, but we were more or less, I guess that's the best word for it, we're more or less stagnating. We have grown, and we continue to grow, and I think we will continue to grow in the future. What worries me is the cuts they talk about, the RIFs, budget cuts, naturally, that's on everybody's mind. What I look for, I guess, on a federation level, I'll be perfectly honest with you, Jason, I'm looking at taking back Congress and keeping our friends in power. We have a lot of enemies, and we lost a lot of friends in the last election cycle, and I think that if we work hard and we do what we're supposed to do, we can take back what we lost. That's what I'm looking forward to.
AFGE 3rd District National Vice President Keith Hill, we appreciate your time and your leadership at AFGE.
Thank you, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll be joined by Michael Zweig, author of The Working Class Majority.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Michael Zweig, the author of The Working Class Majority, America's Best Kept Secret. Michael is also the director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Welcome, Michael, to the program.
Thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
So introduce us to your book and tell us a little bit about it and what your main point is in writing it.
Well, the main point is that we live in a society where class is real important in the way that we also understand that race and gender are important. One way to think about it is to say, suppose that you knew somebody who's black and somebody who's white and you could see the difference, but you did not know that there was race or that race was an important, you know, part of society. You really wouldn't know a whole lot about those two people. Or if you knew that one was a woman and one was a man, but you didn't know there was gender, you also wouldn't know a whole lot about the experience of those men and women that you could see are men and women. But if you didn't know that underlying social reality of gender, you would have a very limited understanding of the life and experience of men and women. And it's the same thing with workers and bosses. Everybody knows that there are workers, and everybody knows that there's employers and bosses. But if you don't know that those represent or are part of a class system, you really don't know very much about workers or bosses. So the idea is to bring class into focus in this country as an important part of social dynamics and an important part of what shapes our lives as working people and as anybody in the society. So that's really the goal of the book, is to bring class into focus in this country and to understand what it means and how it works.
Michael, as you were going through your research for the book, where did it lead you in terms of your analysis of class in the United States?
Well, often people think about class in terms of just income, so that most people are in the middle class, but there's a fringe of rich people at the top and poor people at the bottom. And as Bill Clinton used to say, those people who work hard and play by the rules are the great middle class of American society. Well, you could divide people up by income, but I don't think it's very helpful. I don't think you get much information or understanding that way. I think it's more important to understand class as a question of power. So there are relationships of power in the country, in the economy, and that it's spread into politics and culture and religion and other aspects of our lives that are a better measure and a better understanding of class dynamics. So we don't have immediate direct measures of power. power. You can't look up in the Bureau of Labor Statistics who's got power and who doesn't. But you can look up at on BLS sites occupations. So we can look up 550 or 600 different occupational titles and know how many people are employed in those occupations around the country and how many are men and women and black and white and Hispanic and Asian and so on, so that we can get a pretty good picture of the occupational structure of the labor force. In doing that, I went and looked at those occupational titles. For example, you have clerical help, and you have cashiers, and you have chefs, and you have cooks, line cooks. You have all kinds of occupations that are in there. And I went through and asked, just for each one, does this person at work have a lot of authority over what they do, autonomy, independence? Do they supervise other people, or are they there just to do a job under more or less close supervision, and they don't have a lot of control over the job that they do, the pace or the content of the work? The people who don't have a lot of control over the pace or the content of their work are people who I would call working class people. Those are certainly factory workers and construction workers, but also service workers, people working in call centers with a headset on their head for 8 hours a day, people who are bank clerks and tellers, people who repair the ATM machines or the metro card machines. Those are all working class people. And if you add up the total number, it's about it's over 90 million people in the United States. It's about 63% of the labor force. So this is not a middle-class society. This is a working-class society. It's by far the majority of the population. And that's why the book is called The Working Class Majority, America's Best Kept Secret. So because class is the question of power, power is by its very nature a relationship. You can't have power unless somebody else or something else doesn't. And so if the working class are people who, when they work, basically don't have a lot of autonomy, authority, or power at work, well, who does? Well, their employers or the capitalists, the people who really give strategic guidance and direction to the corporations and businesses in the United States. And that turns out to be, if you look at the boards of directors and the top executives, about 2% of the labor force in the United States. So you have a working class of 63%, a capitalist class of about 2%, and then there is a middle class that's in the middle of those two polar classes. That middle class is managers and supervisors, small business owners, and also professional people who typically do have a fair degree or some significant degree of autonomy and authority in their own work. And there we're talking about lawyers and doctors and people who are CPAs, accountants, not bookkeepers. Bookkeepers I would put in the middle, in the working class. But accountants and senior executives in these and executives in accounting firms, middle class professionals and managers. So that's the basic finding, is that there is a class structure that's based in power relationships. The largest number of people in the country are in the working class, and they are in direct relationship with a small number of people who are the capitalists and the sort of captains of industry and finance. And then you have a middle class that's sort of in between.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Michael Zweig, the author of The Working Class Majority. Michael, based off of that analysis and research, what does that say about our country, the United States, and how does that compare to some other developed nations around the world?
Well, I think most developed nations around the world have a majority of their population in working class positions. It's just the nature of a capitalist society, whether you're in the U.S. or in Japan or in France. It doesn't really matter what the specific political or social arrangements are. If it's a capitalist country, most people are workers. And they work under the sort of strategic guidance of a rather small number of people who run the major corporations and the major economic institutions. And that's common across all capitalist countries. So what it says for the U.S. and for all these countries really is, if we want to understand the sort of political and social dynamics and the cultural dynamics in the country and the economic development, we need to look at the problem as a class-driven problem. So, for example, people know now pretty well that there's a big increase in inequality in the United States. Inequality of income and wealth has grown very dramatically in the last 30 or 40 years. And it's very well documented, and it's reflected in the Occupy movement's cry from the 99% to confront the 1%. And that is a reflection, as has been very widely reported, of a concern for these great inequalities. Well, you know, there's a saying in America, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And while that's been happening for the last 40 years, I don't think it's helpful, really, to think of it that way. I think it's much more helpful to think of it as the working class is taking it in the neck, and the capitalist class is going to the bank with a smile on its face. That, I think, is really what is going on with these changes in distribution of income and wealth. It's a change in the power relationships between labor and capital. And so what you get is a capitalist class which over the last 40 years has been consciously and deliberately dedicated to increasing its power, consciously and deliberately dedicated to reducing the power of working people through the destruction of unions and through changes in legislation and a whole variety of ways. And so rather than just see, this is just the same old story of the working of the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, there's nothing you can do about that. Well, there is something you can do about it if you understand that the problem is to increase the capacity, the organizational capacity, and the strength of working people, whether they're in the private sector or in the public sector, whether they're government employees or whether they're working for General Motors or Verizon. This is what the task is that working people need to reverse this power grid and the relations of power. And that means a whole host of very practical steps that follow from that understanding.
So to balance out that power a little bit, how do you see something like organized labor fitting into that? Is that something where employees could look to have maybe more autonomy in their work or more controls over their work?
Well, that's certainly what unions are for. Unions are not just about getting more money, although let's not ignore the importance of getting more money, particularly when everybody's so very strapped right now after all this changes in income distribution. People are real incomes have fallen over the last 40 years. Workers now make less in real terms after you take account of inflation than they did in 1973. But more people are working in families, so that the family incomes or household incomes are a little bit higher. But that's only because there's this huge increase in the number of people who are working to get by at the same basic level that we had, 40 years ago. So I think that we do need a stronger labor movement, not just dealing with issues of income and wages and benefits, but dealing with the very nature of power in the society. And that unions, I think, need to come away from just thinking about their own members and representing their own members, as important as that is, but need to have a broader view of what the power struggle is in the society and come together as a labor movement to organize and mobilize working people around the country, not just in collective bargaining, but in a broad social movement that can really challenge the corporate elites for power. And we're not doing that. And that's, I think, one reason why we're on a downward spiral here for working people in this country.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue our discussion with Michael Zweig, the author of The Working Class Majority.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Michael Zweig, the author of The Working Class Majority, America's Best Kept Secret. Michael, we spent a number of minutes in the previous segment talking about the capitalist class and the working class, but how about the middle class and public sector workers? Where do they fit into this?
Well, the middle class, it does exist in the country. This is not a middle-class country where everybody or almost everybody is middle-class, but there is a middle-class, as I was saying, of professionals, of small business owners, of managers and supervisors in the corporate world. So this middle-class is kind of caught between. It has certain aspects and certain parts of its life is connected to the working class or is like workers. For example, small business owners often don't have health insurance. They can't afford health insurance like a lot of workers. A lot of the lower level management comes out of the working ranks of workers, foremen and lower levels managers. So they have a background in the working class, but they're in the middle class. So they have aspects, but they're also there to implement the plans and policies of capital. So they represent the boss. They represent the owner. Or a small business owner might also be hostile to unions at the same time that he has a lot of similar interests with workers in other regards. So the middle class is really kind of in the middle of that power grid and of the interests and politics that are characteristics of workers and the corporate elite. So, for example, if you look at those parts of the middle class whose lives are most closely and whose work is most closely associated with workers, so a lawyer who's in a public defender's office, or a doctor who's working in a clinic in a working-class city, those middle-class people have done rather poorly in the last 30, 40 years. As the working class has gone downhill, the people who are associated with them and serve them, work with them, have also gone downhill. Small businesses in working-class communities that have suffered when jobs go overseas, that kind of thing. Those parts of the middle class that are most closely tied to the capitalists, not lawyers who are working for public defenders, but were lawyers in corporate law firms, not doctors who are working in working-class community clinics, but doctors who are in wealthy areas where they don't have to worry about insurance because the patients can just write a check. Those people have done very well, as the corporate elites and the capitalists have done very well. So the experience of the middle class in this country is a divided experience. It's divided by the divisions between the working class experience and the capitalist class experience. So that's, I think, a very important thing to understand if we're talking about how to do politics and how to address the interests and the needs and the experiences of professional people. And in a certain way, the government and government employees are in the same kind of situation. The corporate world is all about privatizing government services and reducing the wages of government workers, throwing government work into the private sector where they can make a profit and where they can break unions and drive down the wages and conditions of workers. We see it at every level of government. The federal government, we see it in state governments, local governments, all being driven by this desire to make profit in every possible aspect of life. And it means that we as government workers, and I am a government worker as a state employee here in New York, we're looking at being caught in the middle of the pressure from the corporate world to privatize everything and to drive down wage standards, and the needs of working people to have public services, the needs of working people to have jobs that pay decent benefits. So we in government work are very much engaged in this class division and class problems, certainly the workers in government, the working class people, the secretaries and the clerks and the people who are operating machinery and motor vehicle operators and so on, but also the professional people, also the economists working in the Department of Labor and the economists working at Commerce and other places who are just trying to be professionals, work to make sure that the government does what it is there to do to serve the American people, and not have to worry that their jobs are going to be cut back because we need to get rid of government so that business can make more money. Those of us who are in government, and professional people as well, need to understand that we need a strong labor movement, not only for ourselves in a union. I'm in the AFT and very in a good, strong union here in New York, but we need to connect our movement, our work, with the broader labor movement, and not just other unions, but immigrant groups and community groups of working people who are fighting for social services, who are fighting for the protection of our needs as working people and our needs as professionals who serve those working people. There's a commonality there of interest that I think we really need to build.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Michael Zweig, the author of The Working Class Majority. Michael, on that issue of lowering wages, lowering benefits, reducing workforces, cutting public services, what do you think the motivation is behind all of that?
I think the motivation is to make money. The private sector wants to get into every aspect. Now, you know, AFGE has the TSA workers. Well, now they want to privatize the TSA jobs. Now they want to have airports around the country be able to go out to private contractors. Well, what's that all about? That's all about getting rid of the protections that AFGE has now finally been able to give to TSA workers. Well, they want to do away with that. They want to make education available only as something which serves the interests of private business. I teach at a university. I've been at Stony Brook for 45 years. When I came there, it was a new university. We were building it to serve working people in the state of New York. Now tuitions are going up. Now the public support for higher education in New York is going down. So where are we going to get the money? We have to go to the corporate world and form private-public partnerships so that our educational mission is now being shifted towards what will build the business community, what will create a better profit environment for businesses on Long Island. That's a completely different mission, and it's all part of the privatization of higher education. And the same kinds of dynamics are going on, privatizing transportation, privatizing social benefits and the provision of benefits, privatizing the every aspect of our work. And I think that what is driving it is a very simple desire of the corporate world to make more money by cherry-picking the best and the most lucrative service contracts that they can get, and then leaving the rest behind, as the market regularly does.
Michael,
through
your analysis of this, what does this lead you to think now about the American dream and upward mobility?
Well, it's well documented that the upward mobility prospect in the United States is now less than it was, and it's also less than it is in Europe today. So, the question of upward mobility is really driven more by the structure of the economy than it is by what any group of people can do. Everybody knows somebody who has started out in very humble beginnings and has risen to great wealth and great power in the economy and politics and culture. Those things happen, and they still happen. But as a social phenomenon, as a way to say, well, that's how we're going to solve the problem, it doesn't work. If you look at BLS data, the Labor Department data, as to what the new jobs are going to be in the next 10 years, 7 out of 10 new jobs that are going to be created in the U.S. economy in the next 10 years are low-wage jobs that don't require anything much more than a high school education. So security guards, home health care workers, and other very low-paying non-union jobs, that's what's growing. So an individual individual might be able to move up, but if those are the jobs that are there and there's no union protections, that's what most people are going to be doing.
Michael, how have politics and politicians impacted or influenced this situation?
Back in 1971, Lewis Powell, who became Supreme Court Justice, wrote what's now getting to be a rather famous memo to the Chamber of Commerce. He was a lawyer in Richmond, Virginia, and a corporate lawyer, and he was working for the Chamber of Commerce. And he wrote this memo in which he said, and it's hard to believe today, looking back, it's in 1971, that this could even be true, but it was true, that the corporate world was very much on the defensive throughout the United States, not just in universities, but in the churches, in the political realm, among students, in the job market with labor. The corporate world was not held in high regard and was held in great suspicion. And Lewis Powell wrote this memo saying, we have to respond to this, and we have to turn this back with a long-term strategy to reverse the power relations in this country. And to do that, we have to address every aspect of society, politics, culture, the universities, religious institutions, everywhere. The corporate world has to stand up and promote its interests. And he was very clear to say, I'm not talking about our interests as a particular business or a particular industry. This is not something that a trade association needs to do. This is something, he says, that we need to do as the corporate world for the capitalist system. That's what we have to defend. And they set about setting up think tanks like the Cato Institute and other of these institutions. The American Enterprise Institute already existed, but they poured huge amounts of money into it. And they built up a network of think tanks, university centers, and politicians who were able to promote this agenda. Judges, you know, they created the Federalist Society. All of that was a strategic plan to increase corporate power and to bring the political system behind it. And so now we have Citizens United, which Jeffrey Clement, who wrote a book, Corporations Are Not People, called the sort of end zone victory dance of the corporate world after this 40-year campaign marching down the field to reverse the fortunes of American business. The American political system is completely rigged on behalf of big money and big capital. There isn't any question about it, and that's true for the Democratic Party as much as it is true for the Republican Party. If you look where the money comes from, if you look what's going on with these super PACs, if you look at the politics and the policies that are being pursued, it's bad news for workers pretty much all the way around across the board. And I think that that is something that the labor movement needs to address. My union, the AFT, you guys at AFGE, auto workers, Teamsters, service employees, everybody has to really think about how we're going to respond to this situation, not just as government workers, not just as Teamsters or truck drivers or hospital workers, but as workers and as people associated and dedicated to the lives of workers who are going to need to come back with a strategic plan to assert working class interests in American society. And that's not a question, again, to mirror Powell's view. This isn't just for this trade association or that trade association or this industry or that industry or this union or this building trades council. This is for the working people of America to take up and in a long-term plan to reverse the fortunes of American workers. Until we do that, we're going to continue to be suffering and continue this downward spiral. And that's why I think it's so important to get class back into focus, because this isn't a problem of the middle class. This is a working class campaign that has to be organized, because that's where the power is in the society. Workers do the work, and workers are the majority of the society, which is so important if we're going to talk about what the meaning of democracy really is.
Michael Zweig, author of The Working Class Majority, America's Best Kept Secret. Michael, thank you for your time and your insight.
Great to be with you. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon, 3rd District National Vice President Keith Hill, and author Michael Zweig. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you.